So, I know you were also away a little bit last week. Did you get a chance to see my message about the wall with thick as a brick?
No.
Okay.
You played the film The Wall, Pink Floyd's
Pink
The
Floyd's The
Wall,
Wall.
with the Who's Thick as a Brick over
It's
it?
Jethro Tull's Thick as a Brick.
Or that's okay, yeah. Derp Alert, yeah.
Now, last Wednesday, I woke up with this idea in my head to do this, and I'm just like woke up like as soon as getting up, it was like it came to me in my sleep, just like woke up. Okay, I have to try watching The Wall with Thick as a Brick, and I start them both at the beginning, and it was like thematically it was super appropriate in ways that I never even had thought about consciously. Obviously, in my sleep, it made sense, but that there are themes of like war and childhood struggle and stuff like that. But so I start them both, start the movie, start the album, and thematically it was kind of appropriate, but it just wasn't working. Wasn't doing anything for me. And then like 9 minutes into the movie, there's just this the it cuts to this scene and you see a newspaper. It's not like super prevalent in the image, but it's there. You see this newspaper cover. Now, Thick as a Brick, the album cover, is a newspaper cover. So I was like, what if I started the album when the newspaper appears? And it works so well.
Oh, nice. I'll try it. That's exciting.
I got a few people to just try 5 minutes of it.
But I want to watch the whole thing, so I'll get back to
Well,
you.
I just want to watch like 4 minutes of it now. I want to watch from not like 9 minutes and 10 seconds to 13 minutes.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words, but a whisper, your deafness, a shout. I may make you feel that I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
I'm forward to watching the whole thing. It looks great.
Yeah, it gets like it just stays so like for the literal things, it's like when he says like he goes like spin me back down the years and the days of my youth as there's like the passing like the cartoons, and then he says draw the lace and black curtains, and then you see like the it passes the curtain in the hotel, and then he says spin me down, and he's like the hotel sign is just spinning, and then obviously cuts to the pool and like that music just like as the video starts like flipping out, the music starts flipping out, and it's just really perfect. And I would say it
Totally.
stays really perfect for at least like 25 minutes. The first ha side of the album is pristine.
Cool.
And then after that, once in the Wall movie, once like the when the flowers start having sex.
Well, you talk to me about The Wall, you name any little anything. I've seen that movie probably more than any other, so I like Bob Hoskins in that movie as his what do you call it? Like he's his manager. Bob Hoskins, obviously, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But I like just like
Isn't
I
Bob
mean
Hoskins also in the Mario Brothers movie?
yes, he's Mario.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Jump through a portal, right?
A big
And
KK
so
Twin Towers.
everything and
Everything.
the H, fucking everything.
Go ahead.
And reptilians. I like every part of The Wall, like I've related to Alice in Wonderland, like inevitably. Like, and I'm not a fan of watching the album over the Disney film of Alice in Wonderland, because I can see, like, if you get the video that's on the internet of that, if you know the wall well enough, you can hear where they changed it. So they'll change the timings of things so that they'll land the way they want it to.
I'm sorry, what are you talking about? Someone put...
When you play Pink Floyd's The Wall with Alice in Wonderland is a very popular sync.
Oh, really? I've never heard of that.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people do it, but it's manipulated. So, like, if you do it on your own, you'll notice that. Like, you're like, oh, but if that was this much different. If you watch any movie with any album, you'll be like, okay, well, about fucking 50% of this aligns. You're like, and then you'll be like, well, if this was a little bit different, wouldn't that be perfect? And it's like, that's cheating.
Yeah, exactly.
Album, fucking make it fit. Like, the whole point of the experiment is when you land on one that you're like, okay, well, fucking 90% of this lands. How the shit does that happen? And so that's what I'm fascinated by. And so, like, the Pink Floyd's The Wall with Alice in Wonderland bothers me because it's not perfect. So why, like, put it on a pedestal? But nonetheless, if you watch Pink Floyd's The Wall, the subtextual Alice in Wonderland element is definitely there, along with the Wizard of Oz. Like, even as he's in the pool, like in the scene we're just watching, and he's tumbling down, for me, I look at that as tumbling down the rabbit hole as a water portal.
Sure, yeah.
I just, my mind goes there. And, like, whatever. I mean, it's all archetypal stuff. I mean, there's nothing more contemporarily archetypal than Alice in Wonderland, but in terms of the introduction of algebra. So I have my whole thing with that. And then it, like, you know, they refer to the other side of the wall as over the rainbow in the wall. They're like, I'm crazy over the rainbow, you know, toys in the attic, surely gone fishing. They must have taken my marbles away, you know. And also the, like, every element of it, the judgment at the end is like Ma'at, you know, you can just see his soul is being weighed, you know. And
it's the trial of Alice, yeah.
Yeah, it's the trial at the end. And so the best part of watching The Wall with Alice in Wonderland is the trial. That's amazing. And, like, it's like what you're saying here, where you have these things that are these gem sequences that you're like, wow, that sequence was fucking amazing, you know, like, Those are cool. Like, you should just put those up on their own instead of looking at the whole film if the whole film doesn't align as well, you know.
Right. As I'm saying, like, the whole first half of the album is just gorgeously pristine, and then where it ends is pretty perfect because it. The entire album ends when he's sitting in the chair staring at the brick wall.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yeah.
So he's.
Well, he's not sitting in the chair staring at the brick wall. He's sitting in the chair at the television, and then he's banging against the wall.
Well, yeah. It's like, how do you want to? So he's sitting in the chair looking off in the distance, and then it cuts to the wall, and then cuts back to him in the chair, and then cuts back to the wall. So it's like, is he staring at the wall?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, open for interpretation.
Yeah, no, totally. But, well, the wall is the television, right?
Exactly.
You're watching the thing. Yeah. It's your wall.
So,
which, it's like, I've been considering the wall as a television set in this way of the Chinese lantern shows. So you know how the Chinese had this whole mystical interpretation of doing a production with lantern shows on a sheet. So they literally have a white wall and then they're projecting shadows onto it. It's a shadow show involved with lanterns behind. But they relate to the wall, the backdrop, as basically like the equivalent of Ein Sof. So that there's this or Purushan in Samkhya philosophy, where you have the spirit that is the unseen thing. It's like ether, right? It's this undifferentiated thing, and then you have the differentiation, or however you'd say that, distinct forms being projected onto this thing that nobody notices the thing it's being projected onto because it's being covered over, so you don't see what everything is atop. So it's the same idea of, like, over the rainbow would essentially be beyond the appearance, right? In the way that the appearance is the projection, and then beyond that is the source. And so I relate to the wall in the same way, where he's trying to break through the appearance of things, which seems plain enough, but just where you can go with that is really interesting.
Isn't there, in the more recent years, hasn't there been a trend in TV, something called like wall-to-wall picture or something? Like where it's like for the big giant screen TVs.
I mean, that would I'm not familiar with the term. I mean, I'm familiar with the term wall to wall, but not in terms of television. But yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, even in like Fahrenheit 451, that was the whole thing. Is this woman's building this room? I don't know when the last time you read that book was, but his wife has this room where the TV takes up the whole wall, and then she's trying to put it on all the other walls. So she's trying to like close herself in with the TV.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh wow. Looked at that in a while. That's I don't remember that part. That's awesome.
Yeah, she's like building a TV room, like that's just all the walls are screens. And like at the opening of the book, there's just one wall, and then as the book goes on, she's adding more screens in.
Which is what happens in the wall in the trial scene. Is he gets literally the wall surrounds him in a circumference.
Right. Like,
looking out from the middle of it, like, or whatever, he's trapped.
Which, of course, Fahrenheit 451 brings us back to the book burning, Donnie Darko banning the books, burning the building.
Yeah, wow, no, I'm thinking about how the irony of them burning the money in Donnie Darko in the story, and then they want to burn the books. In regards to what the subject matter is of the book, they want to destroy the thing because of its subject matter, which is also they're upset with their own interpretations, or they're afraid of their own interpretations.
Absolutely.
Itself, it's like people attacking Catcher in the Rye when it's the way that Catcher in the Rye is being interpreted that's the issue, and not the book itself. So that's like a whole Kantian kind of argument. Like, are you really having a reaction to the thing in itself, or you having a reaction to your interpretation of the thing? And then the levels of interpretation that we don't realize are still interpretation. Like, how far does the interpretation go before the thing actually begins? And it's pretty fucking far.
Yeah, how do you judge something? How do you perceive something without perceiving it? How am I not myself?
Right. And so that's the whole meaning of Da'at, and that's what I'm like really obsessed with in terms of the Clifotic tree at this point, because that's the whole meaning of it. Is it's just, you say don't put any gods before me, meanwhile as soon as you think about the tree or you represent the tree in any way, what are you doing? You're putting a god before. I mean, that was the argument that people made towards Kabbalah in the first place, is they felt that they were making up a new pantheon. They're like, you're just trying to sneak a new pantheon into something that doesn't include that.
Right.
But then meanwhile, they're like, no, these are intelligences, and they're trying to express that, you know, these are the dynamics of a thing and not necessarily like gods and goddesses as were thought as such. But the difference, that the issue is that those pantheons of the past weren't related by the hierarchy as being like gods and goddesses. They are intelligences and their ways to understand aspects of the psyche and how they manifest and coming to form a symbolic language in order to interpret something.
Well, it's the same way as saying, like, you know, if you put the paths of the tree, are the paths to reach the crown or the Ein Sof or whatever, you know, like, basically, this is the pathway to God, but the argument of putting something before me is almost like Dorothy having to travel down the Elbic Road only to learn that she already had what she set out looking for.
Right.
You already, no right. God is already present and manifest. There's no pathway to God. It's already present.
Right. And so that's what's interesting about the focus of Ramak, is that his main concern is Ema. So he's looking at it from the perspective of Ema in most of his writings, where instead of it being this ambitious thing of scaling the tree like Madonna's Kabbalah, you know, Madonna, the
yeah,
musician,
I know, yeah.
That literally, like, it's not this ambitious thing to surmount. His focus is on the downpouring and how it's being distributed, like, basically our life force. So, and how it's being restricted as a result of us not being receptive to it. And then that gives an argument for what the meaning of Kabbalah is in the first place, as to receive. Kabbalah literally means to receive. So if you're not looking at it as just a reception thing, but something like, or something that isn't flowing through you, like there's a difference between, the difference between something that's flowing through you that you're not able to grasp and you're like, you know, okay with that. Or if you're trying to cling to realization or whatever, like that's a big difference. Like if you're looking at it from a materialistic point of view, that there's something in the etheric realms that you can literally get, that's kind of backwards. I thought it was interesting that the word for etheric in Hebrew is dak.
Really?
Literally pronounce it like dak.
What's up, Doc?
Which is great when you think of Lepus as being an expression of the etheric plane.
And
right?
Danny is the shining one.
Right. And so I like it too because you, exactly. And shining, yeah. So Apollo literally means the shining one. And so Danny wears his Apollo sweater. He's identifying himself as the shining one. This is according to Nietzsche in The Birth of Tragedy.
I think I make this mistake regularly, but it's like, so obviously in Masonry, Sirius is the blazing star, but I think it also, the name means something like sparkling or shining. But I make this mistake all the time. I always forget what it.
Torch. So the scorcher.
Scorch. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. See, I do that all the time. So Apollo's the shining one and Sirius is the scorcher.
Yeah.
So, hey, could I ask you a question? You mentioned Badada. This is a bit of a sidetrack here, but, you know, you guys do a lot of things with, like, playing movies and albums. But I had this thought as I was driving back from New York this weekend. I had this thought, two different thoughts about, this would be a lot harder. It's almost like watching two movies at once, but listening to two pieces of music at once. And it'd be a lot harder to sort of process, but I had two thoughts. I saw an ad for Madonna's album MDNA,
mm-hmm.
which of course is like DNA, but it's also like MDMA, which is ecstasy.
It's Hebrew, the way that they're representing it, like how you would spell it if you were spelling it in Hebrew. If you were to spell Madonna in Hebrew, that's how you would write it in the equivalent.
Right. But I'm saying it's also... It's all of those at once. It's like a Hebrew play, it's a DNA play, and it's an ecstasy play.
Right.
So what I was thinking is that Lou Reed has an album called Ecstasy, and I was thinking about pairing Madonna's MDNA with Lou Reed's Ecstasy to see if there's anything there, or maybe watching like 24-hour Party People and putting those two albums with it. Something like that. Or, you know, something like that. But then I also, towards the end of my road trip, I had this thought. Paul McCartney and Wings' song Band on the Run came on. And it occurred to me that Band on the Run is, like, very similar musical structure as Sgt. Pepper's Day in the Life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Just, like, kind of, like, change, but just, like, very, very similar structure. And I'm listening to Band on the Run, thinking of Day in the Life, and I was like, I want to play these two over each other, or like do like the left track of one and the right track of the other.
In most cases you'll end up with a train wreck. It's the same thing like I was talking about playing films together. There's very few films that you can work that way. I mean, the reason why I was inspired with that was just because I never turn the volume up on a film with an album, except with the exception in the past, I've every so often turned up the volume of Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite with Echoes, Pink Floyd's Echoes, because the volume, the sounds are just so etheric, it doesn't really affect it. After Bill suggested watching the new Boards of Canada album with Blade Runner, I watched that like four times, and the time when I felt like I got like a timing that was like really like it was actually on point. And like the way I run the experiment whenever I do this is I watch it from a timing and then I take note of all the times where I'm like, that could have been different. and then see if the reoccurrence of that could have been different, all align the same way. That's for like, if you're experimenting and you see that and you're like, well, if that was 3 seconds different, that would have been right on. But then it happens again and it's the same 3 seconds, and then it's the same 3 seconds, and then it's the same 3 seconds, and that happens enough times. That's when, as far as a personal confirmation is concerned, you're like, okay, I can't explain that. Because if that happens 40 times, if you're like, well, that would have been perfect if, and then what do you know, you change it and they all land in place and all the pinpoints do that. That's like, it does a personal convincing thing. So that's not that common, but that happened with what Bill was suggesting with Blade Runner. And so I turned up the volume on Blade Runner and the whole soundtrack is ambient. There's no music in that movie other than ambience. And it's perfect. Like, you can watch the film. You're like, I'm watching this film and I just made a new soundtrack.
Right.
You know,
I mean, there's
a soundtrack to this film that it didn't have before. And it gives it another level of depth, which is very enjoyable. So I was like, okay, well, what films can I watch that have a resonance that won't interfere too much with each other? And The Shining, actually, if something doesn't have a beat, you can get away with a lot with just playing things simultaneously. So I'm like, The Shining and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was entertaining. I mean, it's like I said, it's absolutely insane to do that. But I mean, in the last month, I don't know how many movies I watched with albums, but I watched a ton. I was kind of repeating my adolescence, because when I was in junior high, there was actually a couple to a few years where I didn't want to watch anything without an album over it. And, you know, my parents could testify to that. And I think I drove them completely insane, even though I wasn't putting it in their face so much in the living room. It was just, I was in my room doing that all the fucking time. And the one that I came up with recently that is pretty damn close to flawless and kind of blew my mind quite a bit was Alejandro Jodorowsky's Santa Sangre and Strange Days by The Doors. The 2-hour version is a longer version of Santa Sangre, and I don't know if you've ever seen that, but I watched Santa Sangre with the shorter version with it, and I was like, God, it feels like it should just go. Like, it feels like these are made for each other. And then I found out that there was another version and did it with that. And then it was just like, boom, there. That's what I was looking for. So that's pretty incredible. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty impressive.
Do you know, are you familiar with Santa Sangre?
No.
It means holy blood. It's his circus freak move.
But it's like... It's the same thing as what I was trying to get at with the Grail at the end of 2001.
Yeah.
Right. It's like the holy blood is in the Grail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So let's swim to the moon. Let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide. Comes on. When the woman and there's this whole thing of the they have their Hiram Abiff character in Santa Sangre that is a woman who is basically instead of the craftsman like in masonry, it's, you know, these guys basically rape this woman and they kill her, and they have a swimming pool of her blood that this woman steps into, and as she's stepping into it, Let's Swim to the Moon is playing. Which in the place I relate to is talking about having sex with a menstruating woman subliminally. So like, it's amazing that song got radio time, because it seems so obvious to me, you know, that that's what it's talking about. But it's like, that's just one example, but there's tons of examples. And like, I hadn't seen the film in a while, and I started watching it with the other version, and I was like, you know, looking at that, it's like Your Lost Little Girl is playing, and I'm like, oh, it's a boy though, it's a little boy, what does that mean? And I'm like, and I forgot that's the whole deal, is that he identifies with his mother and literally takes on the role of his mother. It's a very Oedipal aspect, very overt in Santa Sangre. So like, every lyric matches and makes perfect sense. And like, let's turn out the lights. Like, when they turn out the lights in the circus, it's like, I mean, I could start naming examples in the film, but there's just so many, it's fucking off the charts. And so the film comes out afterwards, and I'm like, okay, well, that, you know, it's like trying to claim intentionality is like, you know, whenever you're looking at a director, you know, it's one thing. But then I'm like, well, fucking that director, I know knows about this deal, and like the one of the few absolute affirmations for me personally, where I know that that a musician is playing with this album sync intentionally, is Marilyn Manson with Holy Mountain. They're friends, you know, like there's too much there. Like, it's just, that is a, you know, a genuine example of that. And so I don't know. I really do think that there's something to that particular sync that's like pretty mind blowing. So
It sounds pretty stunning. Yeah, like I said, I mean, this is funny to me because I have mixed feelings about the whole movie album thing to begin with, of like what, how do I say this? Like, is this for art? Is this for synchronicity? Ultimately, these things don't really worry me. It's like, I like a little bit of all of the above. But when we get into subjects of like intentionality and stuff like that, because you could say someone's familiar with these themes or these, you know, if the album came out after the movie, someone could have done this, you know, or like you've talked about, you know, Pink Floyd and Jim Henson, you know, that connection there or whatever it might be, where obviously someone likes something, but
Pink Floyd, Stanley Kubrick.
Right. But it's just hard because I feel like when we do the work that we do, and whether we're talking about synchronicities and like I like synchronicities in you know, like world stage stuff, whether that be politics or just news events or things like that, or you're talking about synchronicities in movies, I feel like we're just always faced with this thing of, is it intentional or not? Or is where does the awareness come in? And it's a continually frustrating area, and at the same time it's one that I don't know how to avoid it. And part of me feels like with this kind of movie film sync, I appreciate it as an artistry, and if there's one place where the intentionality almost seems like I'd almost like to fully avoid that conversation. And I'm not saying you can't. I hope you realize I'm not saying, like, dude, don't talk about that. I'm just saying, like, it's the area where I'm like, I hope we can learn to just appreciate the artistry of it. Almost like, you know, like a DJ remixing something, where you can take two pieces of music and synthesize them into something new.
Well, it's misleading because it's not that they're doing it, it's that they're participating.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So more of like a pushing it into motion. They find an anchor point. This would be theoretically the way it would be done, is that one would find an anchor point, and then from that anchor point, they're literally like allowing it to like, they're literally a medium, so that they're setting something into motion and they're giving it just enough push, but then it does this thing on its own on top of it. And that's like, it's a extremely creative process. And the argument for people, like, it's for me, it doesn't feel as much a question as like, why would they do that? But why wouldn't they do that? Because when you're doing that, not only does it inspires what you're doing in the first place and gives it an added level of depth, but it also, because the nature of it being secret, like everything not wanting to say secret societies because people have their ideas around that, but like secrecy in masonry, you know, is very important, not just because you're trying to, in many cases you're trying to manipulate, but beyond that, there's a value to, like, you'll see it in your personal life that, I mean, although we have a radio show and we're talking about all these things, there's certain things that just can't really be communicated.
Absolutely.
And so like if you try to, sometimes it's just like, it's extremely frustrating, especially if you're trying to communicate it to somebody who isn't as resonant with something that you may have experienced. Like, if you have a very profound experience, you're like, let me tell you about it. It takes away from the depth of the value of how that experience is working on you. And so that I recognize. And so at the same time, like if I'm working, looking at a movie sink that just completely, I have a relationship to the thing that's not like, it's a deep thing. And then I'm like, you got to see this. I'm trying to convince somebody of something. It's like, it takes away from what I'm getting out of that interaction. Because I personally feel like I'm interacting with an artist, whether they intended to do something or not, I'm interacting with their work. I'm playing with their work, both with film and the it has this other value on that level. But I could see for an artist themselves, like if they were to do that or create something in that way, it's a way to assure that though they're putting that piece of art out into the world, they're keeping part of it for themselves at the same time. Because there's a way that they get to relate to it that is personal. A secret means personal. Like if you keep something secret, it's for you, you know, and whoever you decide to show it to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there was a guy, this is going in a different direction with it, but, you know, you have a right to secrecy. Like, it's funny, in the last few years, like with the rise of the conspiracy movement, there's the idea of, one, that the government is cracking down on, like, that we have no privacy anymore. We have the NSA tapping our phones and our internet searches and all our emails and all this stuff, which we're, of course, outraged by. And then at the same time, the same movement that's outraged by that wants to expose secret societies. And it's almost like, but they are a private group. Like, you know, why? It's, you know, you can make a different argument for government. Like government agencies, there should be more transparency, you know, or whatever. I think is a different argument than saying a secret society, you have to expose them. They are a private, you know, if you and I decided to get together and have this conversation and we didn't want to share it with someone, what we're doing is we're having a conversation that we choose to share with people. But if we didn't want to share that, we are fucking way more than entitled to do so. We are private citizens who want to have a private conversation. And if some group wants to do that and call themselves Freemasons or call themselves the Illuminati, it's a weird sort of hypocrisy to say, I want to expose their secrets, their conversations, their thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. If they didn't want to make that public, isn't that kind of their option? Isn't that their right?
Right.
And of course, then, you know, you can get into trickier territory with corporations and so on, so on. But obviously, if someone's doing something criminal, then it starts to become a different story, and that's where we reach all this gray area. You know, if there's this massive conspiracy, is that in some way criminal? If there, you know, it just gets really complicated. But I just think it's a really interesting little moral and intellectual dilemma of how do you fight for your own privacy and at the same time try and expose someone else's secrecy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, that is really interesting. The whole Snowden thing is like beyond him, but the act of whistleblowing is paradoxical in that sense. Because when the whistleblowing has to do with the privacy that's being invaded.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels like to call it a hypocrisy is misleading in terms of what the real issue probably is.
Okay, so I'm trying to distinguish a government agency that's doing something illegal and is spying on American citizens is a criminal act, and exposing that isn't necessarily I'm not calling that hypocrisy. I'm saying trying to expose the secrets of Freemasonry is somewhat hypocritical. Because especially there's like in the libertarian-ish patriot movement wing of the conspiracy crowd, there's the idea that that the citizens have the right to privacy, the government does not have a right to privacy, which is the, you know, sort of the idea that America was founded on. the government doesn't get to have secrets, but the people get to have secrets. We get to have privacy, and the government has to be open and held accountable. Now we've moved into a modern era where that's reversed, and where the government has all the secrets and we have no privacy. So exposing that is at least is not necessarily hypocritical. It's consistent with the foundational principles of America. What I'm saying is different from a government agency. Masons are not government employees. You know, obviously there might be some crossover, but if I joined a Masonic lodge, I'm not forfeiting my right to privacy. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so
it
it's the idea.
Sense.
So I'm saying, like, the Patriot movement that's saying, hey, citizens have the right to privacy and the government does not, are then at the same time, a lot of them are trying to expose quote unquote Masonic organizations or secret societies. And that's what I'm saying is it's inherently hypocritical because they are private citizens.
Right. I also wonder about the idea that, like, I mean, there's different sides to it because there's people who are involved in these organizations who are coming from completely different ways of that they're relating
Absolutely.
To it. And so, and I consider, like, ideally what the great work is like, you know, you we're doing something important here to, like, unveil something. And that ideally, I guess the notion is that when the time comes, you know, I mean, the apocalypse is literally the unveiling.
Yes.
Of ourselves and what we are in relationship to one another, and so and you know to
right.
ourselves.
So when
and
all
so,
is revealed, there can be no secrets.
Right, and so there's a reflection that's happening now. It's like it feels like we're existing in this pressure cooker, and I do my best to, like, back up and gain a perspective that's beyond my particular lifespan and think about what this means in the greater context of development. And how, like, oh, you see me, oh, I see you, oh, we see each other, oh, my God, like, oh, this is what we are. Like, it's like, you know, you're like, oh, okay, so we know now that if you have a camera on your laptop, it's very possible that at any time, you know, you could be looked at by somebody, which means if you're watching porn and jerking off, that somebody sees that, and it's like, oh, my God, you know, and, like, what people are doing, it's like, oh, they can see me. It's like, oh, like, I don't know. It's like, you might watch me, but I watch you too. Look, we're all looking at each other. It's like, what it was like, I don't know. I but then again, there's the idea, like the 2001 game of chess, right? Where it's like, you want to maneuver the thing in such a way. But I look at 2001 as like the Beyond the Infinite issue of, like, how he's relating to Hal with the chess game. And how there's this, like, kind of, like, underhanded thing, and he shows him the pictures, and then the images that he's drawing are actually reversed, and so he flips over the ones that are flipped appropriately, meaning that he knows what the reality is. He knows that he's being shown a false representation, but he's actually documenting the right one.
Yeah,
right?
I do know what you're talking about.
And so I like the idea that, you know, he's attempting to maneuver himself to go beyond this dimension of thinking and relating, which is one of predator and prey, which you see at the dawn of man, right? And he's trying to surpass that in evolution. And yet he is himself within a film, like he's in a box, you know, and he's trying to get out of the box. And, like, that's the whole thing with the glass is, like, he's transcended, but he's still transcended within the confines of the structure. Like, he hasn't gotten outside of the monolith. He's still in the monolith. And so, like, that's the whole... Do you see what I'm getting at? It's
kind
of abstract
and this
weird.
It's funny because what you're presenting is the same paradox that I'm presenting. And it's why I'm saying it's inherently hypocritical. I'm not trying to place judgment by using that phrase. Like, I don't know if you got to hear the show that Bill did last week. I mean, he was trying to express some similar ideas, but from a different point of view that I'd certainly disagree with. And, you know, there was a part of me that wanted to maybe pick up that conversation today or something. So it's like, on a personal privacy issue, like, I'm super supportive of all this stuff. And I even though I've known for years or accepted for years that these guys have been spying, I appreciate a whistleblower that would try to expose such a thing. Even though it should be common knowledge, it's obviously not, and it's always good to have proof and et cetera. And it's I'm not happy that these things are happening. I guess my point is that where we have a paradox and we have a moral and intellectual dilemma inherent in this conversation, because how do you unveil things? How do you expose things while keeping your own privacy? How do you try and expose the secret goings on of mystery schools or secret societies, while at the same time trying to hold on to your own personal privacy? And this is essentially the same esoteric paradox that you're trying to explain. So it's like not saying that I'm pro NSA, far, very far from it. What I'm saying is that like it's we're just in a really interesting time, like of trying to wrestle with these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, on a deeper level, it feels like the main conundrum is a really weird thing, a difficult thing to communicate. But this is like the area of what I'm studying, is that it comes down to beauty and how we relate to beauty. And so the veil of Isis is literally her skin, which is our skin, which is, Kabbalistically, they'd say that the skin itself is the klipot. So when Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden, they literally put on skins, is how it actually translates, which you could take is that this is, and then they also take, like, this is the thing with Ramak, is that he looks at the Torah as the skin, which is also the skin of the serpent. Like, we're wearing the skin of the serpent, and that's what we see when we look at each other. And so to reckon, to like, the actual revelatory states of how much depth you're able to perceive into when you look at an object is how much you're able to recognize the deeper levels of beauty. So if you're looking at just a superficial level of beauty, like if you're getting off on beauty on a lower chakral level, you experience what comes of that, which is more and more birth. So you create, 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 like you divide and multiply. Whereas if you are relating to beauty on higher and higher like planes of existence, like this is the I take this also as like the meaning of the airplane, right? It's like you have an airplane crash, you have an intellectual crash, right? The airplane being the level of the intellect. But even beyond that, you're trying to no mortal can peer through the veil of Isis, which means if you're relating to yourself on a gross level as your identity is strictly like the external expression or the densest expression, then you cannot pierce the veil of Isis because you're not in a position to perceive what her actual beauty is. And this is how I interpret the significance of the placement of the lust card in Crowley's tarot tableau as the Vesica Eye, right? So this is the
Can
cornerstone of the
I
eye. It's
ask
literally.
you to pause there, because I want to see if maybe we're saying the same thing or maybe we're not. The way I would understand it is when you're saying relating to it on a lower chakra level as opposed to relating to it in its true sense, wouldn't the true sense be all on all understanding it on all levels? So you're appreciating the spiritual beauty, you're appreciating the esoteric intellectual beauty on that airplane level, but you would also on a lower chakra level be relating to it as a beauty. So like you see a beautiful you
Yeah, that's why it has to be
yeah thank
integrated.
okay yeah
That's
I
the
just want to make sure it's like not saying like relating to it on a lower chakra level is not a bad thing, it's just that you have to do
Oh,
it on all
yeah.
levels.
Well, yeah,
yeah
that's you can't have any
yeah
aversion. And that's what they teach you like in Vipassana, right? Like that's the only thing they teach you really in Vipassana is to relinquish a desire and aversion. So you experience something without resistance, without judgment, without and therefore without fear. So whatever arises, you embrace. So, and this is the idea is that you yield to overcome, right? This is the essence of martial arts. So, like, this is how I interpret the meaning of the tower being Mars, is that you have, the tower and where it falls on Crowley's arrangement of the Vesica, the major arcana, the hero's journey, right, is that it's positioned opposite the lovers, which is the duality. So you have the singular tower with the open eye, so the eye sees the thing, and in the scene of the illusion collapses. All we're talking about with the tower is the collapsing of illusion. Yeah. We're not talking of any actual tower. And so this is how it's being represented. And so if you want to collapse the tower, you have to basically reconcile the duality.
But wait, you said when we're talking about the tower, I know this is abstract. I'm not trying to split hairs here. I apologize. But you said when we talk about the tower, we're talking about the fall of illusion, not any actual tower. But I think that is duality, to say it's this but not that. Whereas I would perceive beyond duality would be that it's the fall of illusion and the fall of a physical tower happens at the same time. This is why 9/11, the towers fall, we actually do experience a manifested level of that. You know, you're familiar with the four worlds of manifestation. So you have – it's taking place on the archetypal level and it's taking place on the manifested level and all the
– Right. Well, Maya is real as far as we're concerned.
Well, so that's – okay. So is – I guess this is the splitting hairs, right? So is this illusion or is the illusion that this is all there is? Does that make sense?
The only reason that makes perfect sense, and the only reason that it's referred to as an illusion is in an acknowledgement of the ultimate truth. Against the ultimate truth, in the relative expression of it, this is an emanation, and so everything is illusion.
Correct.
But this is our level of relating, so it might as well be real as far as we're concerned. It's just I'm just speaking from the perspective of the ultimate,
right, but
which isn't my own physical perspective of what I'm capable of.
Precisely,
at this time,
yeah.
I can infer.
And you and I are in the same place where we're human beings. We have limited perception. But the way that at least I would, I guess for lack of a better term, intellectualize the all, which is probably a dangerous thing to do, right, is to intellectualize it. But I'm saying like the way that I can kind of grasp that, or the closest I can get to grasping that, is that to know that this physical 3D realm exists and is vital and important, but it's also not all there is. So you try and appreciate the spiritual and appreciate the physical and appreciate the intellectual. And so like it's when you say it's all this is an illusion because it's manifesting from something, is to say that if you can appreciate, then learning to appreciate everything that is manifest and appreciating what it manifested from. So,
right. I mean, that's a classic argument amongst the Vedantins, is that you're dealing with this is the core issue. And it gets lost in translation because whenever anybody wants to communicate it, it always sounds like you're removing all empathy, you're removing all anything, and it's like, it doesn't have to be that way.
Right. Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard because you end up almost in this sort of paint yourself into a corner of, if all you want to appreciate is the Ein Sof of where it originates from, and everything else is essentially illusion or lesser, right? We've had the conversation where it's like, if you can think of it, it's not it. You know, so there's that idea.
Right.
It's like, not this, not this, not this. And at the same time, there's the other side of that is, well, if all of this is an emanation from that, then is it yes, this, yes, this, yes, this, yes, this?
Well, the reason why you say not this is because you're relating to it in terms of vacuum dynamics, as the ancients described it, which is like, I cannot not see that when I'm looking at the text, because in Kabbalah, specifically 15th, early 16th century Kabbalah, is that they're literally describing something that's being pushed out. So on one end, it's being pushed out as the Malkut, the Shekhinah, is at the base, which is literally the tip of the genitals. So when you experience an orgasm, you're literally pushing everything to a singular point. If you go on the other end towards Keter, you're literally pushing everything to this point. It's the it's an orgasm in the opposite direction. So you have evolution, which is birth in the world, in the duat, and then you have birth, resurrection on another plane, and then they're the same principle being applied in two different ways.
So the orgasm in the other way is a sort of sublimated bringing it back instead of cycling through. It's hard to, this is so abstract, but rather than being stuck in the cycle of birth and death, you're literally recycling it. I don't know if that makes,
No, it does. It makes perfect sense. And this is the meaning of, as soon as you start the fall, which is just be fruitful and multiply, literally fruitful, like the fruit of the garden, right? So you eat of the fruit and then everything starts dividing. This is, I guess, the meaning. Like, people could take this in various ways. But the way that I interpret it is we set this thing in motion, and eventually it leads us to, we're going to build temples, which are going to be a reflection of ourselves. Everything that we build with our hands expresses what we are back to us. And so we are experiencing on this level birth, growth, decay, and death, which is literally splitting in order to multiply. And so we build a temple with its pillars, this is the meaning of Joachim and Boaz. It's established in strength, but that it inevitably will collapse because we ourselves collapse. And it's just what we do. We exist on this level as a mandala.
Yeah, it's even in a real garden, it's the idea of something starts to fruit, which is what you want. And then if it starts to flower, it'll go to seed and stop fruiting. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to prevent it from going to seed. It's almost like a delayed orgasm, a tantric act of keeping the fruit growing and holding off the release of the seed. But in nature, there you come to the point where you have to let it go. It will eventually go to seed. You can, there's this very Western idea of we can have forever fruit, but you can't get that without Monsanto. So eventually it's going to have to go to seed, and you're going to have birth, death, decay. At some point it will go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. Completely. And so I take this as the meaning of the arcana, is what you just said, essentially. And that literally the open eye of the vesica, when you arrange the major arcana, specifically of the Thoth Tarot, you literally, the eye is expressed as the open eye of Shiva. When the eye opens, the universe ends. And that is the meaning of the apocalypse. So that, when we come to see things as they are, everything as we've known them ceases to be. And so when you know the arcana as such, if you recognize what's actually taking place, the dynamics behind the thing, you're bringing an end to its current way of expression. In other words, everything moves on a level of inertia, which is like in Donnie Darko, like the spear emerging from your solar plexus, right? Everything's going to run according to God's path, right? But God's path is set in motion by a set of dynamics. And if these dynamics are recognized, then there basically an opening occurs where shifts can take place, but only along the lines of what's within the parameters of the path, which are it's evolution is taking place. And in order to shift the evolution, an involution has to take place. So that's the purpose of meaning of yoga. Yoga is against nature.
Right. Now, this is going to sound what you were saying there about see if I can kind of. I don't know. You made me think of something, and I'm sorry. My brain is. I'm trying to process so much of this that I apologize if this comes across scattered. You might have to remind
Whatever.
Me what this had to do with what you were just saying, but. You made me think of, we had this, saying unfolding according to God's plan. Okay.
Well, I'm saying that because of Darko,
right,
the way
right.
that they express.
Exactly. I'm not trying to put those words in your mouth. I'm just along these lines. So, I had this conversation. Basically, Melissa and I had borrowed this car for a little over a month. And the car had no car antenna on it. But she had to do this long drive. So her dad put this antenna on it, which is this kind of weird makeshift antenna for the car. And it made it the whole drive back to where we live. and she was like amazed that it stayed in there and that it stayed on going across the highway for hours and hours and hours, but it made it back. And then had the car here for a few days. We didn't even really drive it. And then one day we go out and the antenna's gone. And there was like a big storm, so like maybe it got blown up. So like looking all over the sidewalk, looking on the street, looking everywhere for it. I walked up and down the block. We hadn't even moved the car, so it's like, where the hell could it be? But we knew it was there when she got it here. So we looked all over for this fucking thing. Couldn't find it. We have used the car many, many times since then. Never found it, never anything. And we were going to do this really long drive to New York and then back. And we were like, God, how do we do this without any music in the car? So, like, all right, let's go try and buy an antenna. And we were just so busy before our trip, we didn't even get to do that. So we were like, put it off to be the last thing we did. Like, after we were at, we found a place that sold car antennas that was open because we were driving on 4th of July. So it's like, we found a place that was open on the 4th of July. We pack up the car and we're just about to leave to start this whole road trip. But first, we're going to stop at the place where they sell antennas. Just as we're putting the last thing in the trunk, I step on something and this like piece of metal like shoots up my leg. Like I step on this thing, it's like standing up, goes like up my pants leg, almost cuts through my leg. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And it's the antenna. Like just as we're about to leave. It just sounds like I don't know if you could understand, like if I can convey how special this felt. And we're just like, what the fuck? Like this thing was like, hey, I'm here, take me with you.
Uh-huh.
And
it's like the artifact is like calling to you. Yeah, it's a tangent universe.
Yeah, it was like this thing that wasn't there for the last month suddenly appeared when we needed it. And so we're like, what the fuck? And so she says, like, my wife says, it's things like this. I don't know if I can convey strongly enough how weird this felt, but she says to me, it's things like this that make it very difficult for me to not think there's like a God or something, or like some sort of plan or something. And I was like, yeah, I know. And I was trying to like come up with a rational explanation. Where could this thing have been for the month? Or like, how did it trying so hard to come up with a rational explanation, I really couldn't come up with one. And I was like, but it almost, as like, to me, it doesn't matter. It's like, even if I can come up with a rational explanation, it's this and that, right? So it's like, I gave the example of saying, you have the science people say, the universe is created from the Big Bang. And then the religious people say, the universe was created from God. And I'm like, well, why couldn't God create the universe through the Big Bang? So it's when you're saying that the Donnie Darko, this is God's plan, to me is like, but you're saying, but it works within a certain range of dynamics. Is like, to me, that's sort of how this all makes sense. And then there's
You have to think like an
exactly.
alien, right? You got to look outside the fucking box, literally.
So, now bear in mind, so what is the 4th of July is tied into Sirius. So here I got my antenna,
Oh, wait a minute. How is the 4th of July? I forgot about that. What is that?
4th of July is, I want to say, the heliacal rising of Sirius. Let's look it up.
Oh, my God, dude. Because that was the whole thing that I was tripping out on, was the connection of the 4th of July at the end of The Shining, 1921, playing Midnight, the Stars, and You, contrasting the beginning of Poltergeist with the Star-Spangled Banner. That was, like, a whole trip I was on for a while there, a couple days ago.
Because
it's the Star-Spangled Banner.
Oh, okay.
Midnight, the
every
stars,
year,
and fucking
every year on July 4th, from our Earth's position, our sun is in conjunction with Sirius.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's something.
So, yeah.
Wow, and then his hands in the position of the magician of As Above, So Below.
Yeah.
In the photograph. Wow. And then it's Jack, which is, his subliminal synchrosphere blew my mind with that. He was talking about Black Jack is 21, which is a Jack plus an ace.
Yes.
It's playing blackjack, 21 is jack plus ace. You always got to have an ace in the hole. Jack Nicholson stars opposite James Spader. I don't know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Ace of spades, death, grandma death. Okay. Interesting.
So then you mentioned the idea of the whole idea of ISIS unveiled. So what Crowley says, right, is that no man has unveiled ISIS, but he takes this to be a play on the same. You know, are you familiar with the Odyssey, where and it's because this is the whole point, is that 2001: A Space Odyssey is obviously referencing the Homeric epic, the Odyssey, where the character goes onto this island and he's fighting a
Odysseus
is fighting a Cyclops, which of course is the one eye of Hal, and the Cyclops asks him, "What's your name?" And he says, "My name is No Man." And then he's battling the Cyclops, and all the other Cyclops hear this tussle going on inside, and they're like, "Hey, are you all right in there? What's going on?" And he goes, "No man is in here. No man is killing me." And they're like, "Oh, okay, never mind," and like walk away. And it's like this whole idea that he tricked them by saying his name is No Man. So whenever they ask, "Are you all right?" he's like, "No man is in here." And they're like, "Oh, okay, you're fine."
So the Cyclops is what can unveil.
Well,
ISIS.
No. The Odysseus becomes No Man to fight the Cyclops. So Dave Bowman has to become No Man to fight Hal. And Crowley says that when it says No Man has unveiled ISIS, you have to become the No Man. You have to become...
Oh, right, which is the point of weighing your heart against the weight of a feather, is that you're no longer identified with your
material
form. Yes, exactly.
It's the egoless self. So so this, in the original language, is Nemo, right? So he becomes Nemo. Nemo means no man. So he's saying, in order to unveil ISIS, you have to become Nemo, the egoless no man. So...
Ooh, that's so awesome with, like, Nemo being a fish.
Oh, fuck yeah. Well, yeah. So, of course, Captain Nemo takes his name from Odysseus, and Finding Nemo takes the name from the same tradition. Now, check this out. I know some of this might go over people's heads because a lot of this is stuff that I did talk about this on an Always Record, I want to say... Episode 10 or 11, it's the image where you see Dave Bowman in the Twin Peaks room. On that episode, I talked about this story. But I had this experience at this pool in New York, and I realized it was all connected to this goddess Hecate. And Hecate, however you want to say it, I've heard it said both ways, it doesn't matter to me. But that... This goddess, she's the goddess of like the triple passageway, the passageway to the underworld, and her mother's name is Asteria. So I had this whole crazy experience in this really insane prophetic vision dream. Then I leave. I actually wake up and go to this pool and realize that the pool is situated between the Triborough Bridge, which is the triple passageway, and the Hellgate Bridge, which is the passageway to the underworld. And the pool is called the Astoria Pool. Well, her mother's name is Asteria. So I'm in this, like, fucking crazy ritualistic spot directly after having this crazy ritualistic visionary dream. So whatever. I was only back in New York a few days. I went to that pool in those few days. Now, my niece, who's this autistic 9-year-old girl, she doesn't say... much. I'm there with her, and she says like she gave herself another name, which might have been really weird if her name was Alicia, Elizabeth. I think she was Elizabeth, and then someone else was Alicia. I don't know. And so I said, "What's my name?" And she goes, old man. And I was like, really? That's kind of offensive. I was like, I don't want to be the old man. And then she goes, so then like later, I said, so what's, I said, what's my name? I don't want to be old man. She says, you're new man. And then she goes, no, you're no man. And I go, so I went from being the old Adam to being the new Adam to being the no man. Like, you know, the uh-huh. Adam Cadmon, you have the old man, the new man, and then the no man. And it was like, are you fucking kidding me? And then as I'm leaving, there's this big sign for next month, they're going to screen Finding Nemo under the Hellgate Bridge.
Oh,
so
no.
She just told me I was no man. Then I see the sign for Nemo on the Hellgate Bridge. And I'm like, fucking insanity.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's
and,
a lot of
and to top it off, just before leaving on this trip, I got this weird bridal catalog, came to my job. I have no idea why. Like, the mailman walks in and says, hey, this is addressed to you guys. I don't know why. And it was this bridal magazine called Unveiled. And I was like, that's the name of your magazine? That's kind of weird. But, so I got the Unveiled magazine. I became Nemo. I think it was a good week.
Yeah, that was a good think week for sure. Huh. I was getting confused because I was thinking about the Minotaur, which is a whole other creature that isn't in the Odyssey. Doesn't Odysseus have to battle the Minotaur as well, or are they two different things? I mean, are they the same thing?
No,
I don't think they are. There's a Cyclops, and there's a Minotaur. And the Minotaur is at the Labyrinth. And that is the Odyssey, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I think the Minotaur is related to
Hercules,
Icarus, I thought.
Icarus? Really?
Minos. I think it's King Minos. God, you're making me pull out my old school mythology here. King Minos is his wife wears a cow suit and fucks a bull, and that's where the Minotaur comes from.
Ooh, that's cool in terms of Donnie with the bulldog.
Yeah, exactly. Daedalus is the labyrinth. Okay. So, Minos was a king of Crete, son of Zeus and Europa. Every 9 years, he made a king, picked 7 young boys and 7 girls to be sent to Daedalus's creation, the labyrinth, to be eaten by the Minotaur. After his death, Minos became a judge of the dead in the underworld. That's interesting.
Ooh, Flight 77.
Yeah. I was thinking of Daedalus. Isn't Daedalus Icarus's father? Let me see. Dun, dun, dun. Yes. Oh, see, I know my shit, man. I know my shit.
Yeah.
So the labyrinth was created by Daedalus, who's the same guy who made the wings for his son Icarus.
Right.
See? My old school geek knowledge comes through.
Yeah. Yeah. Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven. I was thinking about the way that Led Zeppelin always pictures Icarus on like many of their album mm-hmm. covers, right? And how their biggest hit is Stairway to Heaven, and how interesting it is to I like Wayne's World when he goes to play Stairway to Heaven and they stop him and they go no, he goes no stairway denied. I think about Icarus.
Yeah,
because it's like trying to ascend with wax wings.
Well, isn't that the same idea as a Led Zeppelin, though, right? It's this thing that shouldn't be able to fly.
But is able to fly
right.
Somehow, and so then it
and
has,
then it cra-
yeah,
has
exactly.
a crash landing though. It's somehow able to fly,
right.
But has
and
a crash landing.
Isn't lead the metal
yes.
for Saturn? Okay, so you have lead and tin. So tin is so yeah yeah Saturn. Tin is Jupiter, and so that's their. The how lead and tin are related alchemically.
That makes me think we should try pairing something with Led Zeppelin and 2001 A Space Odyssey, because obviously it was supposed to be Saturn, not Jupiter.
Yeah, I'm down. I was thinking, I don't know what to do with Led Zeppelin. I was going to play Led Zeppelin with The Hobbit, actually. That felt like really appropriate, but I wasn't sure which one to pull that with, like maybe House of the Holy or something. It seems so obvious to me that the story of Icarus is about psychedelics, because the wax wings are like the wings that'll take you so far, but they won't take you all the way. So, like, looking at, like, the way that they would have communicated that, it seems, like, really direct to me. I like how in Pi, Max's teacher, Saul, which literally is the sun, right, tells him, he's like, he's looking at his fish, and he goes, while they're playing Go, he's looking at the fish, and he goes, I named him Icarus after you, my renegade pupil. You fly too high, Max, you'll get burnt. I like how it's renegade pupil. Like, you could look at it like David Bowman's, like, pupil. Like, it's a renegade. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's like Iris would be the renegade pupil, right? It's like Bowman's rainbow pupil, like, going off and doing its own, doing another thing. I don't know. It's kind of abstract.
Who is the guy who gets out of the labyrinth, though?
Danny.
Theseus. Okay. All right. I just want to make sure it wasn't. I was like, I really don't think it's Odysseus, but just want to check. So Danny. So obviously, so there's. It's interesting because you have the idea that Theseus, the way he gets out of there is by using a string, right, so he can retrace his steps and stuff, which is basically what Danny has to do, is retrace his steps. But it makes me think that he uses a ball of string, and that Danny keeps getting the ball tossed to him, or the way the ball rolls to him. Just saying, like, it's... It's less obvious, but
you know, pill literally means ball. The word pill. So it's interesting that it's two pills that are offered by Mobius to Neo in the Matrix. As he's,
here are my balls.
I don't know.
Take a look at my two balls.
It's like literally balls, which you could take as like eyeballs. You know, I mean, you're seeing them in his glasses, but at one point I looked that up and thought that that was kind of interesting. So according to A.B. Cook, Minos and Minotaur are only different forms of the same personage representing the sun god of the Cretans, who depicted the sun as a bull. That's interesting. If you look at the labyrinth in The Shining, that Jack is looking down at, when you like outline a Mayan pyramid, and then you can see that Danny and Wendy are at the top of the pyramid, which would be like the pyramid of the sun that the serpent goes up the side of in Mexico. It's like a Mexican pyramid.
It's kind of absolutely, yeah, and it ties in with the idea, of course, of Jack being the Sun King and all this sort of going to the Sun Road.
Oh wow, this is emphasized by the fact that the little girl in Donnie Darko, his younger sister, wrote her short story, The Last Unicorn, which we all know is, Rosemary, Mia Farrow is The Last Unicorn. But that story, The Last Unicorn, has the red bull.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so here we have, wedded to Dionysus. Okay, I'm just going to read this. He and J.G. Frazier both explain, I don't know how to say this, Parsifae's union with the bull as a sacred ceremony at which the queen of Knossos, I don't know how to say these things, was wedded to a bull-formed god, just as the wife of the tyrant in Athens was wedded to Dionysus. E. Potter, who does not dispute the historical personality of Minos in view of the story, I'm butchering the language, I'm sorry, but Phalaris considers it probable that in Crete, where a bull colt may have existed by the side of that of the Libres, I don't know, victims were tortured by being shut up in the belly of a red-hot brazen bull. The story of Talos, the Cretan man of brass, who heated himself red-hot and clasped strangers in his embrace as soon as they landed on the island, is probably of similar origin. Is this kind of neat? I don't know. I'm thinking
the
of
flaming,
the red bull.
Flaming red bull, that. But yeah.
It was simultaneous, because I was thinking about the red bull of the last unicorn in relationship to the Minotaur, and then they actually have this like belly of a red-hot brazen bull the victims were shut up in. It's kind of neat. And then that would be at the center of the labyrinth.
Right? And even Donnie Darko, if you've seen the editor's cut of Donnie Darko, I mean, essentially he's trying, it's like he went into the alternate dimension and he has to find his way back out. It's sort of like that wormhole in the sky is his thread back out of the labyrinth.
Exactly. But I should probably jump off this conversation.
Yeah. Awesome.
But yeah, this is great. Thank you for continuing on with me for a little bit more. This is really kind
of
crazy.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I missed this. So, like I said, I think a week off always does people good. Like when Bill was feeling burnt out, then took a week, and he came back, like seemed really excited. We took a week, came back. So I think that always does a good job.
Totally. There's like way more in my notes that I haven't mentioned, and that is fine because there's always next time.
Unless the world ends, and then
world ends, which it probably already has, and we're existing in a tangent universe. Okay, I find it interesting that apparently the guy who did Donnie Darko also did Southland Tales, which is like this is how the world ends, not with a whimper but a bang. How many days? I like that he also says when the world ends in Donnie Darko, this is the end of the world or whatever, but he doesn't, when he says the times he in which you take as a countdown throughout the film, Frank doesn't actually say that. All he says is 28 days or whatever it is, 28 days, however many, whatever. But he never actually says that this is the countdown to the end of the world. That is extrapolated by Donnie, which I don't know if that means anything at all, other than maybe the fact that it's always already, I guess. So the apocalypse now.
Oh, yeah. Now, what? There's also the idea that you have, like, I mean, first, if you want to keep it with movies, you have the movie called 28 Days Later. Which is about zombies or the undead, and according to the director, Donnie Darko, in his alternate dimension, all those people are dead.
Right.
So basically, Donnie Darko's in a land of the undead zombies, and then you have a movie called 28 Days Later, which is all about zombies, pretty interesting. But there's also, you know, the end of the world, but it's also, if you want to take this as some sort of weird wormhole Star Child thing, woman's menstrual cycle is going on that same lunar 28 days or 27.3 or whatever. So you have the idea that if you are – you ventured into this wormhole, which is like a sperm heading for the egg, and you have to try and touch that sacred artifact before it all collapses, which is going to – you have 28 days to do – is very much like Dave Bowman. It's very explicitly as he's going through the Stargate that he's sort of in this floating space ejaculate to become this fetus.
Right. It's getting forced out. Yeah, it's like it's all getting narrowed down. Yeah, totally.
So, like, you can see when he's the Stargate sequence, there's this, like, milky fluid, and then you start to see, like, little bits of the embryo forming and all this stuff. So it's, like, to me, very obvious that it's meant to be like a really zoomed in, spaced out version of the formation of the Star Child in that sequence. It just seems interesting to me that Donnie Darko would essentially have, even though it's, in real life sperm doesn't last that long, you know, it can't survive for 28 days, it seems interesting to me that that's the window in which he has, because then the whole thing is going to collapse in on itself, which is essentially what the uterus does. You know, it's like starts to tear the wall. Ooh, that's interesting. You tear the uterine wall. It's like tear down this wall, or the whole Pink Floyd, you know, tear down the wall.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and that you could look at it like the fabric of space is represented symbolically in that movie. Like, you can see when they're jumping on the trampoline, the black trampoline, they're literally doing the way that the fabric of space is represented. Like, they're not piercing it. They're just bouncing along the fabric of space. Whereas, like, what is the vortex but, like, an actual, like, rift in it, right? Yeah. It's a dark rift. A Darko rift.
A Donnie Darko... No, through a scanner, Donnie Darkly.
Oh, no.
On that note.
Wow, I should watch Scanner Darkly overlaid with Donnie Darko. That's a... I'd probably get some real deep truth out of that, but I would only see it through a glass darkly. So,
the field, it's covered with blood.
Blood? That is it.
We should get back to the burrow.
Back to the burrow? It'll come there. Don't think it won't. It's all around us.
Now stop it, Fiver.
We've got to go away from here.
When the other rabbits hear of Fiver's vision, do they believe him?
Why should we care?
Because the rabbits are us, Donnie.
Why should I mourn for a rabbit like it was human?
Are you saying that the death of one species is less tragic than another?
Of course. A rabbit's not like us. You know, it has no history books, no photographs, no knowledge of sorrow or regret. I mean, I'm sorry, Miss Bomber. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, I like rabbits and all. They're cute and they're horny. And if you're cute and you're horny, then you're probably happy that you don't know who you are or why you're even alive. And you just want to have sex as many times as possible before you die. I mean, I just don't see the point in crying over a dead rabbit. You know, who never even feared death to begin with.
You're wrong. These rabbits can talk. They're the product of the author's imagination. And he cares for them, so we care for them. Otherwise, we've just missed the point.
But aren't we forgetting about the miracle of storytelling? The day... Ex Machina, the god machine. That's what saved the rabbits.